Today, the calm before the storm. The DFA Daily to the 2nd of May 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The latest from the Fed shows it grew its balance sheet by a mere 1.3% this week, or $28.8 billion. That is the smallest rise since early March, though the balance sheet is now 68% bigger since then, up $2.89 trillion to a record $6.65 trillion. They came in hard and early, and they're now easing back. In fact, the Fed cut its purchases of Treasury securities up a mere $62 billion, while the balance of its mortgage-backed securities fell to $1.6 trillion, and repurchase agreements, or repos, have fallen into disuse with just $158 billion left on the balance sheet. Foreign central bank liquidity swaps, after peaking in the first 2 weeks, expanded only a little, with the Bank of Japan up by $18 billion from the prior week to $214 billion, which is 49% of the total swaps on the Fed's balance sheet. The helicopter money for Wall Street continues, but consider this, if the Fed had spread that $2.34 trillion equally over the 130 million households in the US, each would have received over $18,000 now. And that would have gone a long way to helping them through the crisis. But no, this is all about financial stability. The cryptocurrency market has woken up recently. Over the past week alone, Bitcoin has moved 20% higher, recovering from $6,886 to $8,200. Its current market capitalization is $149 billion, or 64% of the entire cryptocurrency market. Sentiment has improved in anticipation of the upcoming halving event, which is going to take place in 12 days' time. Bitcoin is designed so that only 21 million coins can be mined, and the reduction in supply is aimed at preventing inflation. Unlike central banks, which can simply print more cash, there is a limited number of bitcoins, which makes it in many ways more similar to gold than to the national currency. The halving occurs every 210,000 blocks. As a result, every time the reward is cut by 50% exponentially. Thanks to halvings, a total of 21 million bitcoins can only be mined by 2040. In the two previous halving events in 2012 and 2016, the price of the most popular cryptocurrency reached new highs, and some think the same may happen this time. And unlike oil, cryptocurrency can even be stored for free using paper wallets or cryptocurrency exchanges. So the bulls are running again, believing that the current Bitcoin recovery may well be the beginning of a new rally, but we'll see. Wall Street was sold off sharply on Friday after President Donald Trump revived a threat of new tariffs against China in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Trump said his administration was crafting retaliatory measures against China as punishment for the coronavirus outbreak, once again sparking tariff fears that rattled markets through much of the last 2 years. Trump has blamed China for what he says is misinformation when the virus emerged from the Chinese city of Wuhan and then quickly spread around the world. So all three major US stock averages closed well down, over 2% in fact, and for the week they all lost ground. Stocks had a remarkable run in April, with the S&P 500 and the Dow both posting their strongest monthly percentage gains in 33 years. And the US corporate reporting season has crossed the midpoint, with 275 of the companies in the S&P 500 having reported quarterly results. Of those, 68% have beaten consensus estimates. In aggregate, first quarter S&P 500 earnings have seen around a 12.7% fall from a year ago. That's a stark reversal from the 6.3% annual growth forecast that was made on January the 1st. At the close on the NYSE, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2.55%, while the S&P 500 index lost 2.81% and the Nasdaq Composite Index fell 3.2%. The Volatility Index was up 8.9%. Gold futures for June delivery was up 0.95% to 1,710. Crude oil for delivery in June rose 4.56% to 1970. And the Euro-US dollar was up 0.24% to 1.0981, while the US dollar index futures was up 0.07% to 99.07. The April 16 to 30 poll of 34 fund managers and chief investment officers across North America, Europe and Japan, with over 2.5 trillion assets under management, showed a recommended cut to equity allocations on average of 45.1% in their global portfolios from 45.9% in March. That would be the lowest in 7 months, and while the yield on benchmark US 10-year treasuries has held around 0.6%, the poll suggested an increase to bond holdings to their highest since the poll series started back in 2013 to 43.3% from 43.1% last month. One of the most common phrases in investing is sell in May and go away. This refers to the strategy of divesting stocks in May and reinvesting in November. This year, there are very good reasons to sell in May, but the question is when to return. The bond market is not pointing at a V-shaped or strong recovery, and instead it is still signaling risk and continued support by the Fed purchases. Responding to an additional question, 6% of fund managers, or 12 out of 20, said the global economic recovery would be U-shaped. 4 respondents said it would be more like a tick mark, and the remaining expected a W or L shape. None expected a V-shaped recovery, a strong rebound from the deep contraction taking place right now. Various measures of the contagion showed signs of peaking in the major economies, and in the coming months, more shutdowns are expected to be lifted. Economies are likely to be bottoming in the next month or so, but there has been much debate about whether the recovery will be characterized by an L, a U, a V, or even a W. At his press conference following the recent FOMC meeting, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said he was more pessimistic than the W camp. Those findings line up with a separate Reuters poll of economists, which showed the global economy would suffer its deepest contraction on record this year, with a longer U-shaped recovery more likely. The US economy suffered its largest decline in 11 years last quarter, with GDP contracting at 4.8% annualized, marking the end of the longest economic expansion on record. And another Reuters poll of economists predicted the worst is yet to come. On Wednesday, the Fed said the ongoing pandemic would weigh heavily on the near-term outlook and pose considerable risks for the medium term. In response to an extra question, more than 85% or 18 out of the 21 fund managers said the risk was skewed more to the downside for stock prices over the next 3 months. At first, the reopenings are likely to be slow and tentative, and activity is unlikely to explode higher immediately. Large social gatherings, including the use of mass transportation and the like, may take some time to rebuild, especially in the absence of a vaccine or effective treatment. The extended supply chains and the desynchronized nature of the epidemic will also complicate economic recoveries. However, the math behind GDP and the change in the change, as it were, does set the stage for a strong rebound later this year. Big drop, yes. Then a rebound of some sort, that's the maths. But unemployment is likely to remain higher for longer, especially as government support is removed later. While the stresses in the capital markets eased considerably in April, they remain on life support provided by central banks stepping up as lenders of last resort. In addition to bond markets, several central banks also supported the short-term corporate bill market and offered guarantees on bank loans. The Federal Reserve indicated that corporate bonds that had recently lost their investment-grade status, sometimes called fallen angels, would be included in its support to the sector. And it also announced that within specific valuation parameters, it would buy high-yielding bond ETFs. The ECB has issued a waiver that allowed it to buy Greek bonds, which are rated below investment grade. And it took another step and indicated it would accept fallen angel bonds as collateral for loans from the central bank. The aggressiveness of the Federal Reserve response should not be underestimated. It has already bought more treasuries and mortgage-backed securities than in the third and most significant round of the QE during the Great Financial Crisis. It has launched 9 asset buying programs seeded by funds from the Treasury Department. The Fed's balance sheet is now a little more than 30% of GDP. The ECB's balance sheet is closer to 40% of the EMU's GDP, while the Bank of Japan's balance sheet is, wait for it, over 100% of GDP. Neither the incremental change nor the proportionate size of a central bank's balance sheet appears, though, to be a good predictor of inflation or the direction of the exchange rate. The Congressional Budget Office projects a deficit of about $3.7 trillion this year, or about 18% of GDP, and a recent Pew Research poll found that around 2/3 of Americans thought the risk was too early of a relaxation of the shutdown, rather than being too late. As we discussed yesterday, the Eurozone again is being stymied by the lack of strong central authority. Its response is hampered by the divide between creditors and debitors in Europe. The European Community has accepted the emergency suspension of its fiscal rules, in fact, and the ECB has been bold with its pandemic emergency purchase program, which it will likely have to increase before the fourth quarter. However, the EC itself, the European Parliament, the European Council, have yet to offer a vision or program. There does seem to be a gradual evolution towards using the multi-year EU budget for a program that will likely include a combination of grants and loans that could be more than 1 trillion euros. Without a bold plan, the antagonism will only deepen and provide more fodder for the anti-European voices. Moreover, it will generate weaker growth and lower long-term investments. The Bank of England meets on May the 7th. With the bank rate at zero bound, the Bank of England could increase its asset purchases, but there seems little need at present. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Sunak, has expanded the range of economic support to include more small businesses. And the UK may be among the last of the G7 countries to relax its shutdown, given the still high death rates. In China, the output of the world's second largest economy fell by almost 10% in the first quarter, but the fiscal and monetary responses remain modest by its own historic responses and what other countries are doing. More measures will likely be forthcoming in the period ahead. The dollar traded in a range of about 7.03 to 7.125 in April and was net-net practically unchanged on the month. China's handling of the virus crisis may put up risk the country's strategic goals, and the UK is expected to soon move to block Huawei from constructing its new mobile network. Several countries are tightening rules aimed at deterring Chinese acquisitions, and the World Health Organization has been criticized for not including Taiwan, ostensibly to appease China, and it subsequently upgraded Taiwan's status. Local government infrastructure projects will help the domestic economy recover, while the exports may take some time to regain traction. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. In Australia, after falling almost 6% in March, the Australian dollar was the strongest of the major currencies in April, up 6.2%. The Reserve Bank of Australia meets on May the 5th, with the cash rate at its effective zero bound at 25 basis points, and an asset purchase program, and targeting the 3-year yield at the cash rate. The meeting is unlikely to alter policy. Still, it provides an opportunity to update its economic and financial assessment. The cash rate does not appear to be setting the floor of interest rates. Instead, the 10 basis points the RBA pays on exchange settlement balances may, in fact, be the new lower bound. At the close in Sydney, the S&P 200 declined 5.1%. The ASX VIX, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P ASX 200, was up 13.93% to 29.62, and the Aussie dollar US was down 0.84% to 64.55. Morgan Stanley said this week they expect a house price decline larger than the previous downturn at 10 or 15%, with more broad-based impacts, particularly in the rental market, while forced selling should remain limited for the next few months given significant support from governments and banks. This is still likely to come through later in the year as these measures are wound back. And Bloomberg wrote, Australia's jobless rate may already have risen to as high as 10.8% based on government data on welfare recipients and on processed claims. The number of Australians receiving unemployment benefits soared to 1.3 million as of April the 24th, from 800,000 at the end of 2019, Department of Social Security figures released on Thursday to a parliamentary committee showed. There were a further 300,000 applications yet to be processed. Based on these numbers, the jobless rate would have jumped to 8.8% or 10.8% if unprocessed claims were incorporated. The number of people receiving or seeking unemployment benefits has doubled since the end of February, with the rapid surge revealing the swift and severe hit to Australia's labour market, said James McIntyre, Australia economist at Bloomberg Economics. This equates to unemployment pushing above 11% over the next few months. By comparison, Australia's rate peaked 11.2% following the recession of the early 1990s. This suggests the Reserve Bank of Australia's expectation for the jobless rate to reach 10% by June is likely to be met, as the economy nosedives during the second quarter. The government's JobKeeper initiative, which keeps workers attached to their employers during the shutdown and a slump in the participation rate, are in fact likely to suppress the official level of unemployment. Aware of this, RBA Governor Philip Lowe said last week his key focus on the labour market will be on total hours worked, which he expects to fall by 20% over the first half of the year. And in the report on Thursday, Goldman Sachs Group estimated Australia's effective unemployment rate, adjusted for the sharp fall in hours worked and participation, is likely to hit 19% by mid-year. And the ABS will release its new weekly payroll jobs and wages in Australia report on Tuesday. And CoreLogic said that the rental markets have shown a broad-based weakening through April as the combined pressure of higher supply and lower demand flows through to lower rents. Rents were down over the month across seven of the eight major capitals, with the largest falls in Sydney down 0.7%, Canberra 0.7% and Melbourne down 0.5%. Perth, where rental conditions have been tightening over the year, has seen a lift in rents over the month of 0.1%. Rental markets were already soft leading into the COVID-19, with annual growth of just 1% across the combined capital cities over the 12 months ending March. The latest data for April has dragged the annual change in capital city rents to just 0.4%. Rents are likely to show much weaker conditions over the coming months due to higher supply levels and the conversion of short-term rentals to permanent arrangements, and the large number of off-the-plan units that have recently been completed or still under construction are adding to rental supply. On the demand side, occupancy rates are being negatively impacted by a stalling in overseas student numbers, as well as many domestic students studying remotely and a stalling in international migration. Demand has been further impacted by the weak labour market conditions associated with sectors that are synonymous with renters, casual employees, accommodation and food service workers, and arts and recreation workers. Unsurprisingly, unit markets have shown a weaker rental performance, with capital city unit rents down 0.9% in April compared with a 0.3% drop in house rents. With rents falling while housing values hold relatively firm, yields have slipped over the month, reaching a new record low of 2.92% in Sydney. And Nicole Pedersen McKinnon, the money contributor at the SMH, wrote, I've written for years that it is dangerous to park your money inside your mortgage rather than alongside it. Well, I'm distraught to report that thousands of Australians have just had this expensively and traumatically confirmed. Parking money inside a mortgage involves paying more than the minimum payments into the loan itself. It relies on redraw and trusts that your bank will let you have the extra money sitting in your loan account if and when you need it. However, Having your cash alongside your loan uses a separate but attached offset account to effectively quarantine your extra payments, giving you full flexibility of access. The safer offset approach saves an identical amount of interest. Since Australia went on emergency lockdown to halt the spread of the coronavirus in mid-March, I've heard so many tales of the redraw strategy blowing up in mortgage holders' faces. Unlike when you have made all extra repayments into and hold any savings in a parallel offset account, some people who have extra money inside the loan itself are being refused the same mortgage payment holidays offered to other bank customers. You are ahead. You can use those funds to meet your monthly obligations, lenders are saying. She said, I broke the story in mid-2018 that CBA was about to sweep away redraw monies. This would occur when a customer's repayments had somehow fallen behind what was necessary to discharge the loan in the contracted term, or when they were ahead but were suckered into a generous offer to reduce their minimum repayments. The newly calculated amount would see this money eventually gobbled up. And it could have been intended for something else entirely, including financial emergencies, the likes of which we are seeing, and just temporarily parked in a loan. ME Bank has just done the same, absorbing savings as high as $20,000, according to some irate customers on its Facebook page. What's more, borrowers were not notified in time to get their money out via redraw and safely into an offset or other savings account. They were posted a letter dated April 23rd, and the redraw adjustment occurred before most had received it on April 27th. This appears to be a contravention of the new banking code, requiring timely notice of product changes. As one customer who lost $19,000 raised on social media, apparently they have calculated the loan repayments incorrectly and just decided to take my money to correct it. Another said, yes, us too. Just under $13,000, no notification, no explanation. And a third commented, my mortgage is not reflecting what they stole from redraw. How does ME Bank respond? Well, a spokesperson told Money, ME identified that redraw facility of some legacy home loans could lead to some customers falling behind their original repayment schedules. We are reviewing the personal circumstances of each customer affected and are committed to working with them to determine how we can help those customers with their individual financial needs. The bank declines to comment on a suggestion that where the available redraw was reduced, it is usually due to a bank mistake in calculating the required repayments. The spokesperson said, for customers whose limits have been reduced, the bank will look to rearrange financing at the bank's costs. The bank is in the process of contacting all affected customers, and all have access to the 3 and 6 month hardship repayment holidays, the spokesperson said. Indeed, the danger of relying on redraw was first laid bare in the US when the global financial crisis hit. Many lenders there simply locked away from owners any extra money sitting in loans, exercising their right to protect the banks. The same is allowed in many loan contracts in Australia. Redraw is a huge risk. Instead, you need the protection of a real offset account, especially today. And we pointed out that ME Bank reported lower home loan balances to APRA in the March return, with a drop of around $4 billion. It appears this is explained by a securitization transaction, which removed the loans from ME's balance sheet. But this also highlights a limitation in the APRA data series, in that lenders who securitize will be understating their true market exposure. Mortgages are transferred to the securitized entity, which is regarded as separate from the original lender. As a result, this will only be reported in the RBA aggregates and the ABS securitization series at an aggregate level. The more you dig, the more data holes you find. And finally, a quick reminder, we're running an additional live stream event and Q&A session next Tuesday, the 5th of May at 8 p.m. Sydney. As well as discussing the RBA rate decision, we'll be updating our latest survey results on mortgage stress and intention to sell. These are important leading indicators which may point to what home prices will do in the months ahead. You can ask a question live in the YouTube chat or send them to me beforehand via the DFA blog. The links are in the comments below. I look forward to seeing you on Tuesday. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.